podcast about the monsters, spooks, and nasty guys that inhabit your favorite fantasy settings. We're your hosts. Hi, I'm Colin, and I can unhinge my ears to listen to podcasts five times my own size.
I'm Noel, and I tend to blow things out of scale.
And today we're talking about Naga, the Kalyanka Jungle, and the Turtle Lens.
Welcome to the jungle. We've got role-playing games.
But first, some news and updates. Well, I mean, you know, nothing really that new, I guess.
Nothing really changes.
Yeah, hey, we're still here. We're actually, yeah, 2 weeks later.
Indeed.
We're not going back to hiatus immediately.
Yes. That's actually an achievement.
Oh, man, that's the curse.
That's the curse. That's the curse. And yeah. Then you go on hiatus.
Yeah. I hope you all are enjoying the show.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you're enjoying the new format.
Indeed.
We've gotten a small amount of feedback. We'd love to get more.
Oh,
we're already acting on feedback.
Yes.
Yes. We understand that this is a new and crazy thing.
Indeed.
Yeah.
We're still getting used to it too, so please, yeah. Take your time. You're good.
I just hope that we get to the point where we have enough stuff where we can touch more than just one thing at a time.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Today we're going to be covering Sneeple, the jungle the Sneeple live in, and then something not necessarily used by Sneeple, but used by, lizard folk.
They're neighbors.
They're neighbors. So, without ado, Naga.
What are Naga?
They're snake people. They're Sneeple.
Sneeple. All right, that's simple enough. Let's move on.
Naga is, there are kind of an old folklore thing from India and Southeast Asia and all that jazz. They originate, the word Naga is an old Sanskrit word for cobra.
All right.
Yeah.
I dig that.
And based on that, that's how, because cobras being a rare, powerful, dangerous snake.
Oh, yeah.
Were revered and probably, worshipped religiously and all that kind of stuff. And that eventually, the specific word Naga separates out from other words from snakes as referring to kind of, the kind of folklore idea of a snake person.
All right. Basically anything that sort of lands in the Naga hood there, it's just considered Naga.
Yeah.
All right.
So, the big thing is in original Naga myths, you have people that might be described exactly how a person is described in one paragraph, and the next paragraph is described as if they're a snake. Kind of vague, but related.
All right.
And as things kind of progress on, you get to, old Hindu stories of snakes that can turn into people, like kind of in the same way that, you treat like a kitsune in Japanese folklore.
Right. Or like, the D&D jackalware.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Like that kind of stuff.
Or selkies.
Exactly. Like selkies. Yeah. Just like we talked about last time. Yeah. Anything like that, just kind of like any of that kind of stuff.
Right.
And especially in Southeast Asia, especially in Cambodia, Naga as just a wholly intelligent snake are very, very important.
By wholly intelligent snake, you mean completely intelligent or divinely intelligent?
Both.
All right.
The emblem of the kind of royal house of Cambodia is a seven-headed Naga, of just a seven-headed cobra, basically.
All right. I mean, sounds a bit like a hydra.
It doesn't have any legs and you can't jump on its back.
All right. That's fair.
It's
a baby hydra.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll let that one go.
Actually, a really interesting thing about Cambodian Buddhism is that the worship of snakes, and especially snakes as dragons in Southeast Asia, gets incorporated into Buddhism there in a way that, Buddha is often wreathed in snakes, or like halos are a crazy thing all throughout the old world.
Yeah.
And the kind of classical early Chinese halo is is almost, instead of just being a circle around the back of the head, mm-hmm. is almost kind of a wreath of flame that kind of goes up from the seat of the body and flares out up around the top of the body.
All right.
And the way that that eventually reaches Cambodian Buddhism is that actually becomes a giant cobra seated behind the bodhisattva or whatever.
All right, that's rad as hell.
Oh, yeah. In fact, at the Chrysler Museum of Art in Norfolk, they mm-hmm. have a lot of really, really good Southeast Asian Buddhist sculptures, and one of them has, like, the full flaming cobra halo thing, and it's really cool.
That is possibly the most metal thing that's ever been said on this podcast. You really can't beat the classics.
You know, combine it with a little bit of Mongolian throat singing, and
Oh my god, yeah. That would just... I need that. Like, I need that album, I need that album cover. Oh, boy.
Yeah. But yeah, Naga are crazy, because, like, you have Naga, which are kind of treated as the archetypal snakes created at the start of the world that are mm-hmm. just as much people as they are snakes.
Certainly.
But then you also have the, like, people Naga that evolve, where it's a snake with a person's head on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, and that, the thing about the snake with human head Naga, they tend to be, if I remember correctly, guardians more than anything.
Yeah.
Like, in the same way that, you know, sometimes a golem can be, or a gargoyle usually is, yeah. they tend to be guardians of, if I recall, temples or vast hoards and yeah. treasures.
And that's also an interesting thing about Naga in Hindu myth in general, is they start out in the beginning of the Vedas. They're very much treated as, oh, this is a monster, and they're mm-hmm. evil, and they're going to try and trick you. But as the story of the Vedas progresses, they often, like, individual Naga themselves show themselves to be incredibly loyal and mm-hmm. devoted to ideals and good. And if not any more morally gray than any other character in that story.
Which I dig. I like that. I like the evolution from, hey, this is bad, to, you know, this isn't so bad.
Yeah. Especially since the Vedas are very, very narrative in the way that they're written. It kind of definitely reads as, early on we're telling you these people are bad so that you learn that they're not bad later.
You know what? That's honestly, if you ask me, a great storytelling mechanic.
Yeah.
It's underutilized.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But yeah, pretty much that's our big thing for Sneeple mm-hmm. for a long time.
Right.
Until Robert E. Howard comes along.
Indeed. Are we talking about what I'm thinking we're talking about?
Talking about Conan, we're talking about Thul, we're talking about all that good stuff.
Ah, yes.
Snake people are a big part of the Conan mythology.
They are indeed.
And yeah, they're basically what it says on the tin. They're snakes and they're people.
Yep,
and they are going to sacrifice you to their ancient snake god.
Right. People who are snakes. Snakes who are people.
May or may not be Yig.
Yeah. Yeah. And really, let's be honest, that's a Yig deal.
Yeah. And you know, in the vein of Conan, you have the very popular podcast Scald. And you know, which is a Conan style spoken word narrative. Man, a whole bunch of the first parts of Scald are all about killing snake people.
I mean, they're one of the archetypal enemies for big burly guys.
Yeah.
It's just, that's what you do.
Well, they're big and burly, and they're also skinny and skeevy, and they're generally aligned with a cult, which means that, well, you're going to kill them.
Yeah, that, like, hits all the three basic things for I am big, beefy guy who kills things.
Yeah.
That's like, you can do, you know, goblins or whatever, but snake people, man.
Yeah. Sneeple. And very much in this vein, D&D picks up snake people.
Oh, absolutely. And runs with it.
Yeah.
Slithers with it.
Yeah. I mean, even from the beginning in first edition, Yanti are a very developed culture.
Right.
For one thing, they're given a specific name. Like, they're not just called snake persons. They're called Yanti.
Which is above and beyond what they do for lizard folk.
Yeah.
They're lizard folk.
Yeah. And I guess the origin kind of goes back and forth depending on the setting and the writer and the edition and what have you.
Yeah.
But Yanti, sometimes they are humans that have you know, through cult practices, transform themselves into snake people.
Right.
Sometimes they're created by a snake god, you know.
And sometimes they're a mixture thereof.
Yeah.
Where the snake god creates the snake people, and then they turn other people into snake people.
Yeah.
And then they learn to breed with snakes, and things get real weird.
Yeah. Because why wouldn't you when you're going to be in a massive orgy ball hibernating through the winter?
I mean, ideal.
But yeah, I know that there are separated, in like a big thing with Yanti is blood, is your breeding.
Right.
And generally Yanti are always separated into breeds. Their typical ones being pure blood, half blood, and abomination.
Quite so.
Yeah.
And even though it's named Abomination, they're my favorite.
please tell me about what, you know, I can understand what makes a pure blooded and a half blooded Yanti, but what makes a Yanti an abomination?
Well, all right. You got to kind of work your way up on this one. Pure-blooded's are basically people with little patches of snake. They got occasionally slitted eyes and forked tongues and scaly patches, and they can usually pass for people from a distance. They can usually pass for humans. I'm sorry. That was my bad. They can
humans? What's a human? We don't have humans in this setting. They can pass for a rat?
They could pass for a rat. Rat.
I guess they could pass for a fairy. That's the most human thing that we have.
A fae, perhaps.
Yeah.
They could pass for the top half of Drider.
Yeah.
But no, they can pass for, in most settings, a human at a distance because they've got stuff that separates them. They're generally not quite as powerful, not quite as strong as all the other Yanti, and they're looked down on. They're the lowest class of society, despite being called purebloods.
Yeah.
Weird. Then you have halfbloods, which are far more snake-like, oftentimes have pure snake heads that are human-sized, have large patches of scales, reptilian claws, which snakes don't have. But you've got that sort of thing going on for half-bloods, and they're basically the middle class of Yanti society.
Yeah.
Then you have abominations, which are literally giant, vaguely humanoid snakes. They have the traditional Lamia Naga tail, the big fat thing that's thicker than most people's bodies that just goes for yards and yards and yards. They have a humanoid upper body that's covered entirely in scales. And they have the same snake-like head that's very large. And that's what makes them my favorite, is because they don't just take, oh, here's a human and let's put a few snake bits on it. It's, here's a snake, let's upsize it and reform its torso. Or give it a torso, actually. And I think that's pretty cool.
Let's just put some rad abs on the snake.
Hell yeah. That's how you design something, man. All right, you know what? This wardrobe's good, but it needs some rad abs.
Yeah.
This beer bottle, it's pretty, but it needs rad abs, dude.
Surprised there isn't, like, an injected, molded, like, glass bottle that has abs on it. Because there's one that's literally the Buddha.
So why isn't that? What? That's a very good question. I don't want to drink out of the Buddha, by the way.
Lucky Buddhas are the good beer.
I get that. I still feel kind of awkward. But there's also the absolute highest tier of Yanti, which I think is pretty cool, but they're not considered, you know, likable in Yanti society.
Yeah.
The Yanti Anathema.
Yeah.
Which is literally basically the giant orgy ball of snakes in human form with a giant snake's head. They are considered the holiest beasts in Yanti society and Yanti mythology, but they're also, since they're just a whole bunch of writhing snakes, far more oriented towards chaos, and they tend to destroy everything around them in most cases. So they're oftentimes kept in cages and dungeons in Yanti buildings and such like. They're fed from high above so that they can't climb up. And despite being, like I said, holy beasts, they are very, very scared of them. But yeah, that's the basics for, you know, Yanti biology and physiology and such like.
I will note that also in this kind of, they don't really seem like subbreeds as they would be, but I know in second edition and maybe in third edition too. Third edition is a weird area for me because it, you know,
yeah,
we never actually played any of it because why would you? the specific Yanti races or some of the specific Yanti races made as player races that the Mage Killer, the Brood Guards, and the Holy Guardians, while basically mostly being Yonti professions, were pretty much, I guess, in the whole idea of Yonti having a very rigorous caste system, being that they're mostly in India XP as far as D&D is concerned.
Essentially.
Yeah. That, you know, you have a few, you know, subbreeds that are made for specific jobs within the Empire that are meant to do certain things.
Right.
I don't think that these two things have ever actually come together in any way, but they're all are also Naga in D&D.
Quite so.
Yeah. They're basically just very large magical intelligent snakes. Sometimes there's usually a fire Naga, there's usually a spirit Naga, there's usually a water Naga, there's usually a multi-headed skull Naga.
Yeah, the bone Naga always sticks out to me.
Yeah.
Also, sometimes they have the human face thing going on.
Yeah, there's usually one that has the whole human face thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're mostly, I believe they count as aberrations as far as D&D is concerned with monsters.
Yeah, but they do also follow the whole guardian thing going on there.
They're basically the lawful aberration, if there is one.
Right, which is weird.
Yeah.
Still, there's got to be one. There's always got to be one black sheep in the family.
Yeah, they're kind of like how, you know, Alottles are the chaotic celestial.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nagas are the lawful aberrant.
Yep. Weird. Also, a sort of related subbreed to Yonti are one that I've actually played before. Just didn't have the name at the time. How's this? One that I've actually played before, but just didn't have a name at the time. Savaklors. Which are basically Coatl-based Yonti. Like Quetzalcoatl, the whole feathered serpent kind of thing going on here. Which I really like, because they tend to be a lot less evil.
Yeah.
They're just kind of existing. There are actually some who make exterminating regular Yonti their purpose.
Yeah.
So I think it's an interesting take, and I really like them.
I definitely, like, with their association with axolotls, it kind of... Because, especially in a lot of, like, local practice, the gap between snakes and dragons is so small.
Right.
That it kind of, like, also ties into that. That, you know, you could easily say that, oh, well, axolotls are, like, dragons because they're, like, Aztec dragons. But it's, like, they're also flying feathered snakes. Like, they're both.
Yeah. It's the same concept, different skin, which is pretty cool if you ask me.
Yeah, definitely.
We got anything more?
There's Warcraft.
All right.
Warcraft has Nagas in it. I don't remember them showing up before Warcraft 3.
Mm-hmm.
But I know they figure into a lot of stuff in World of Warcraft and everything since that.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, they're mutated night elves.
What isn't?
Well, everything is a mutated elf, but these are specifically mutated night elves.
All right. Yeah. I see.
Basically, in Dawn Immemoria, there were a bunch of night elves known as the Highborn. That practiced strange magics to, you know, make them immortal and et cetera, et cetera.
All right.
And at some point, they think it's a good idea to summon demons. And that is the first invasion of the Burning Legion into Azeroth or whatever that...
I think it's Azeroth.
Yeah, whatever that fucking world's called. Who knows? And yeah, they kind of stop doing the magic and they kind of beat them back, but it pretty much comes down to the leader of the Highborn making a pact with the old gods to save their people and turn back the demons, etc., etc.
And this is what happens when you deal with the crotch of the old gods.
Yes. Part of what happens in that is their continent/city gets sunk down to the bottom of the ocean.
Oh, lovely.
Where they were pulling magic from the Eternal Well, as opposed to what the life tree is, what the Night Elves are going on all about in present day. But there's a well too. There's a well of magic, and they're all about it. And they used it to summon demons. And so now it's been sucked down to the bottom of the ocean. And part of being exposed to that magic and being saved by the old gods gradually mutates all of them into snake people.
All right.
But they're not, you know, in classic Warcraft, well, in classic World of Warcraft fashion, they can't just be snake people. They also have to be covered in huge scales and big old pointy bits and huge fins. And,
of course.
Yeah.
Actually, it kind of reminds me of the take that Guild Wars 2 did on them with the crate. Just big, lizardy, snaky, fishy people.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't like when my snakes and my reptiles get mixed together. I don't know what it is, but it just makes me feel really weird.
All right. I get that feeling occasionally.
Any other Sneeple we need to talk about?
Aside from the ones controlling the government, I think everyone knows about them.
Yeah. It's definitely not a conspiracy for any kind of diamond-based hegemony.
Not at all. Not at all. Although that would absolutely be a gem if we found it.
Oh, yeah.
Not that I can think of.
Yeah. I guess that's Naga.
That's Naga.
Yeah.
That's snake people.
Yeah. Good old-fashioned snake people. Living underground a lot of the time and worshiping dark gods.
Oh, yeah, usually the dark gods. Like, what's his name? Zahir?
Zahir, yeah. I think it's Zahir.
That's neither Zahir nor there.
So, yeah, I guess now for our Leviathan locale of the episode.
Love it.
Yeah. I believe Tauzerk does, in fact, have some Naga in it.
Indeed.
And where did they live?
In a place called the Kalyanka Jungle.
Yeah. Which is kind of a really fucking crazy place.
Just a little bit.
I mean, you know, jungles themselves are dense. Even if they're not, you know, there's kind of a big thing with when, you know, Europeans were exploring African and South American jungles during the Age of Exploration. A misconstrued thing is because rivers make natural causeways that make it easier for plants to grow out and get sunlight, that basically when you're looking at the side of a jungle on a roadside or a riverside, you shouldn't think of that as how the jungle is all the way through.
Right.
Basically, what you're looking at is the canopy curling down and going straight down to the ground.
Yep.
There's this thick shell of leaves and twigs and branches.
Oh, yeah.
And once you get through that, and once you get into the jungle proper, the floor and the, what's the under... But basically, the understory and is pretty loose, and the forest floor itself is actually very, very well manicured because there is such a comparatively small amount of decaying matter at the bottom.
Right, and I imagine some lacking amount of light.
Yeah, I mean the big gauge is that the forest floor itself gets about 2% of light.
Makes sense.
The understory gets 2 to 15%.
Better.
The canopy gets 15 to, 90, and then the emergent layer of just trees that are tall enough to break through everything everything else.
Yeah. And eventually, I imagine it turns into canopy.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Who lives there?
Who lives there? Well, you have, of course, you have Naga that live there.
Of course.
And they are mostly living underground where they like to live.
Indeed.
But also, you know, there are plenty of stone temple complexes that peak above, kind of iceberg style.
All right.
And a lot of those clear land out around them, so they're kind of islands amidst the jungle, as it would be.
I like that.
Yeah. Which makes them very defensible against the reigning creature in the area, which are droiders.
Indeed. Spiders with human bodies.
Yeah.
The closest thing we get to humans here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're...
Technically elves.
Yeah. Technically elves. We could call them fae. We could call them... call them hairless rats.
True.
In this pink setting... orcs. Black orcs.
Ooh. Blorks.
Skinny trolls.
Horrifying.
They're a spider body with a humanoid body perched atop it. Right. Or a humanoid torso perched atop it.
Quite so.
Yeah.
And given that they are spiders, they're pretty darn good at climbing.
Yeah.
Perfectly suited for the, you know, everything above ground in the jungle.
Yeah. And the great thing about silk is that the only resource you need to make silk is calories.
Yeah.
Basically.
You just gotta eat.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, you're making an entire city, silk, wood. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
You might put some substrates into your silk. You might concentrate your silk into a very particular form for certain parts.
Right.
But, you know, basically you see a drier settlement up in the canopy, and it's just a honeycomb of webs in a cloud right underneath of the tree line.
Right. If you've ever seen bagworms, imagine something like that, but with an eye for architecture.
Yes. with some embellishments and some flourishments, like, sewn in.
Certainly.
Yeah. But that leaves, a lot of, Naga might be doing some very, very, very light gardening and farming around their settlements above ground.
Of course.
Maybe some underground, mushroom farming, that kind of thing.
I imagine that sort of thing would be fairly common. Yeah.
But, nothing above sustenance level,
Right.
If they're getting stone, they're using it to make temples.
Yes.
If they're getting any kind of ore, any valuable resource, they're putting it towards that bent, because Naga are very religious.
Very incredibly religious. Yeah. In Kalyanka, the Naga themselves form just the basis of all religious society there.
Yeah.
There's... Imagine Mormons, but with snake tails.
Yes. And, loosely interconnected, but only because there's the drive to continue to make increasingly complex complexes, and you've got to link them together.
Oh, yeah.
And I imagine each individual temple is very cultish, very, very into its own thing, mm-hmm. but they have to be connected with their snake brethren, their snake sisters.
Absolutely. You don't want to miss out if someone's found the new word of whoever.
Yes. or found a new whoever with a word.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The whoever could just be a word.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's a thing to explore.
Yeah. And meanwhile, you have all these driders up in the canopy, and they can move about as they wish, and they're very adept, very intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And they're definitely not going down to the forest floor to, harvest fruits and vegetables and that kind of thing.
No, not at all.
Yeah. They're mostly just going to be, taking what they want from the people who do that.
Exactly.
And who are those people?
Well, I'm glad that you asked, because they're some of my favorites. The fairly common, rat folk, of course, who populate almost every corner of the world. Then you have kobolds, who do the same thing, but slightly differently. And you have lizard folk, who, between the three of them, take up a fair amount of the population.
Yeah.
Who make up a fair amount of the settlements above ground and under the canopy.
Yeah. Like, it's definitely still very diverse, but...
Oh, yes.
Lizard folk definitely edge out the other minorities with a majority.
Certainly, certainly.
You probably find plenty of kobolds, plenty of rat folk.
Definitely.
Probably the occasional troll, too. Yeah.
I would imagine a fair population of goblins as well.
Yes.
Definitely.
Oh, definitely goblins.
I actually imagine they would be a problem for the snake people,
yeah.
for the Nagas.
Yes.
Honestly.
Because what doesn't look like a better place to live than an abandoned Naga fortress?
Exactly. I mean, honestly, I can just see a whole pack of them taking up in a Naga temple that hadn't been used for a year.
Yeah.
And they come back to it and it's just horrid.
Yes.
They might have, abominations of their own, but that's an abomination.
Yes.
It's just terrible.
But yeah, most of these races are just trying to, make ends meet. And luckily, the environment they're in, jungles are incredibly vibrant. There's
yes.
going to be, tons of insects and birds and different animals through all different levels from forest floor to canopy.
Oh, absolutely. Given the average biodiversity of, a jungle or a rainforest in our world, imagine that, but with added races.
Yeah. And, it's going to be the kind of, added biodiversity that really doesn't need any agriculture.
Right.
But I imagine that the driders still manicure, the lower levels of their jungles.
Oh, certainly.
To make it, to a point where it's easy for different sentient races to thrive and survive
right.
and move about, so that it's easier for them to then pick up said races and capture them, sell them off. To the gnolls, to...
Oh, definitely.
Lizard folk in other lands, to...
The fae.
The winter fae, yeah.
Absolutely. Although that would be absolutely hellish for anyone captured.
Yeah.
Given that they are the Winter Fae and, you know, cold-blooded.
Yes.
Oof. Terrible.
It's probably the one good thing for the gnolls is the fact that probably most of the rat folk in the jungles get sold off to the Winter Fae because they're the only ones that can handle it.
Yeah. Precisely. They're not interested in buying people who sleep and then die.
Yeah.
But no, I think that makes the Dryders a dominant force in the world.
Yeah.
Given basically their economic output. Not something that most other people produce, so that makes them valuable.
Yeah. And to that point, you know, the nature of Dryders is the, you know, kind of the surrounding countryside. When the jungle dies off, they really don't have anywhere to go. There's, you know, there's some mountains that maybe they might occupy a little bit of. Mm-hmm. I know that we outlined a town that they go to specifically that is a slave market.
Yes.
But, you know, the swamp that the lizard folk come from, not hospitable to them at all.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah. It just, they're not going to be good on ships. They're not going to be good on the plains, the Minotaurs, you know, take to.
Right.
So, you know, while they are probably a very, very powerful military encampment.
Right.
They're not going anywhere.
No.
They're staying where they are.
They are absolutely fortified.
Yes.
There is no possible way. And I imagine that as a part of that, they actually keep up, you know, like you said, they manicure the jungle's lower layers.
Yeah.
But I imagine they also keep up the borders and occasionally try and reseed and replant what's been taken.
Yeah.
Because there will inevitably be people logging. Be people taking the wood and whatnot, even, you know, beating back the military force that is the Dryders. Yeah. However, when that happens, they'll always be interested in taking it back, because the more they lose jungle, the less room they have.
Yeah, and that's probably why that their kind of number one enemy is the Naga, because the Naga will pop up from underground, clear out some jungle, make a giant stone temple on top of it.
Right.
And then not leave. And just the nature of the difference between the dense jungle and then the rocky encampment makes it a complete war of attrition if it were to happen.
Exactly. It's basically two immovable objects.
Yeah.
Like there's no unstoppable force here. It's just two immovable objects crushing up against each other.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yes. And that definitely works to the Naga's advantage, because really all they care about is enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
and divine favor and that kind of thing. They could care less about what resources may or may not be exploited outside of where they're occupying at this exact moment.
Right.
As long as they're breaking even for their own processes, then they can keep going with, you know, doing their rituals and making their sacrifices and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Which is probably why that they both, one, don't really care that most of the surrounding population is being enslaved.
Right.
And also, two, aren't trying to enslave them themselves, because, you know, the lizard folk, the kobolds, etc., that run around them are, the goblins are, they're, you know, they're people to be culled in and proselytized to.
Right. They're to be evangelicized, not enslaved.
Yeah. And you know, they're not the people. They're not the people of the blood or the cloth. So
right.
they're not super important, but they're there.
They're there. I mean, more sacrifices are better.
Yeah.
More tithing is better, that kind of thing. If you wanted to run tithing, if you didn't, that's...
Yeah. You know, I'm sure that their temples, you know, much like Angkor Wat, with its ever-expanding, you know, gardens and agriculture and that kind of thing. Like, they've got enough to get by.
Oh,
but I'm sure they're not going to deny, you know, a bunch of goblins running up with bags full of fruits and flowers and candied insects ready to be eaten in exchange for divine favor.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like that would be their main export, would be culture and religion.
Yeah.
And that would be something which they don't actually have to produce much for.
Yeah.
And it just reaps benefits for them.
Yeah.
So I feel that's how they get along in the world.
I feel like one of the most interesting parts of this has to be the lizard folk, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're definitely significantly different from the Naga.
Oh, yes.
But they're closer to the Naga than they are to the Dryders.
Absolutely.
But the Dryders are the ones that are constantly assailing them whenever they leave a safe location.
Yes.
So how must that feel to have kind of this... this older brother race that won't do anything for you, but will be kind of the stepping stone for you to, oh, you know, you should talk to old Zahir. Maybe he'll help you out.
Personally, I'd be irritated.
Yeah. And I'm sure that the lizard folk have their own, you know, religious practices that we'll go into. But they're probably just as distrustful as organized religion as they are of organized militaries.
Oh, yeah.
So probably the way that the lizard folk operate day to day is much more of, you know, what we might describe as like shamanism or ritual hedge magic, that kind of thing.
So I always turn back to when we talk about lizard folk, I see a sort of paganism kind of thing going on.
Yeah.
I still 100% pull for Scottish lizards.
Yeah. I love Irish lizards, my greatest contribution to anything I've ever done. but I feel like that might be an easy way to quickly define how the major spaces are devolved.
Right.
Where you have the Naga, where when they look at a plant and they say, this is the pure ideological form that this plant represents. This is the abstract themes that we associate with this flower and mm-hmm. how we would use it in a ritual.
Right.
And the Driders are looking at the same plant and they're going, well, it's got nectar. Bees can make honey out of that, and we can use that as a calorie source. We can also use it to make wine.
It's also a fair antibiotic.
Yes, it's fair antibiotic, and you know, it might have X and X, you know, medicinal or aphrodisiac or whatever properties.
Right.
And meanwhile, the lizard folk are in the middle, where they go and they look at that plant and they say, if I make a poultice with that plant, will I say these words over top of it and mix it with the other things, I can make a potion that will make me virulent in combat.
Right. It's a sort of a mix between practicality and spirituality.
Yeah.
And it's, if you ask me, ideal.
Yeah.
That gets you where you need to go. Where do the kobolds fit in all this?
I feel like, oh man, so I guess to talk about kobolds is to go back to goblins.
Yes.
Goblins specifically want a space that is built. They want to occupy a ruin. And if they can build that ruin, that's great. But if they can't build the ruin, they're kind of fucked. They have to find a ruin that's already built.
Build the ruin. That describes goblins perfectly.
Or ruin a building, you know, whatever.
Yeah. No, they're interchangeable.
Yeah. Whereas kobolds, I feel like, are very much more adept to occupying a naturally existing space and volume.
Right.
So, you know, I would say that in this exact instance, in a jungle, a kobold settlement is just going to look like a bunch of kobolds in bushes and trees. And maybe it's, if you really pay attention, you can notice like, oh, those branches are woven together. And that, the way that tree is naturally split apart has made like a natural cavity and the kobolds are occupying that. And they're like, oh yeah, they're down in the roots. And right. They've just dug out some of the loose like rock that's in the roots.
Right.
And you know, maybe he, you know, I'm sure a kobold would love to occupy an abandoned Naga temple.
But it's already taken.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure they'd love to fight with some goblins over it.
Oh, yeah.
But I imagine that the Naga civilization is not so old that the inner core of their temple network is completely abandoned to building new temples.
Yeah. Not yet.
Yes. Maybe in about 200 or 300 years when we hit, you know, a late Renaissance setting. Get into some early industrial stuff.
Perhaps.
Yes. That'll be a whole other podcast.
I feel like if you look hard enough, you'll find a kobold hole.
Yeah.
That will lead to a small kobold den that's absolutely packed.
Yes.
And that's the absolute most advanced form of kobold living in this jungle.
Yeah. And I'm sure that there, that, you know, kobolds would, you know, for maybe a couple weeks at a time, might live the high life, making a little canopy tree fort.
Right.
Eating bugs and fruit and finding shiny flowers and what have you.
Right.
But, you know, a month goes by, a Drider notices them there, and they're like, oh, well, now we have to kill all of them, because no one wants to give a foothold for a kobold, because you know what that leads to.
Oh, yeah. It looks like we have vermin. turns into, why are they overrunning?
Yeah. Enslave them young, I guess.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that's another kind of comparison point between goblins and kobolds.
Right.
Is goblins are going to tell tales about driders, about why you need to stick low to the forest floor, about why you can't, you know, you can dig greedily to a degree, but you can't build greedily.
Right.
Because your Tower of Babel will be struck down very quickly.
Right.
Kobolds are not going to have that. Kobolds don't care.
I feel like out of every species, out of every race in this entire setting, kobolds and rat folk have the most advanced breeding. They have the fastest breeding.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And the rat folk, they're just kind of there.
Yeah. I'm sure they move in and out as much as they do.
Oh, yeah.
Probably there, you know, there might be one or two kind of exact settlements of natives that have, you know, a couple, several generations going back. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it's just as much, you know, rats that have been enslaved and gone off to the desert and come back trying to find their homeland, or, you know, rat folk that have grown up in the cities in the inner sea and then tried to, you know, strike out and reclaim some land, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And for this week's Artifact or Fiction, we're going to be delving into a little practice of the lizard folk of Kalyanka.
The lizard folk's turtle lens.
Yeah. So yeah, lizard folk, being a very, very nomadic people in this exact part of the world, they don't really have a ton of trade goods. You know, most everything that they have is going to be, they're not going to have a lot of processed goods. You're not going to see them running around with a bunch of, you know, ceramics or ironworking or that kind of thing.
Certainly.
Unless they've bought it off, you know, a Naga or what have you.
Right. There would be a fair amount of trade, especially for a nomadic species.
Yeah.
But they're not so much. They tend to be more naturalistic.
Yes. So, you know, if they have a spear shaft, it's going to be an especially straight piece of wood that they found and modified for that benefit.
Right.
Or if they're, you know, making, you know, if they're carrying water, it's going to be out of a, you know, a cured, you know, animal bladder, that kind of thing.
Right. Things you can make. Things that you have access to everywhere instead of having to pull a special resource, then refining it, then shaping it. That's just not their digs here.
Yeah, they don't have the time for it, because life is chaotic and you have to be on your feet, even when you're in the village.
Quite so.
Which leads to the importance of divination magic.
Yes.
Yes.
Because if you can tell the future, you have to use it.
Yes. Which is what a turtle lens is. A turtle lens is a turtle shell that has been polished.
Yes.
And formed. You know, not to a huge amount, but it, you know, it'll hold liquid.
Right.
And essentially, based on what the small detail of life that you're trying to discover, you will go and find the proper plant, animal product, mud, dirt, whatever, to determine, you know, who you should marry and couple with to make a brood of eggs.
Right.
You might find, you might go collect the nectar or the pollen of a hyacinth flower.
Makes sense.
Or to get advice from an ancient relative of years past to know how to proceed with your life. You might collect mud from where their bones were buried.
That seems to make sense.
Yeah. Et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You would collect this material. You put it in your turtle lens, in the bowl of the turtle shell.
Right.
And then you will go and collect some rain or some leaf droppings from the canopy. And the first few drops, how they splatter into that material and the shape that it makes, the kind of granularity that it disperses in, that is how you make your divination.
That seems actually fairly intricate.
Yes. And very much, you know, while it isn't necessarily a magical item, I would definitely say that this falls under the purview of what many would consider an arcane focus in mechanical D&D terms.
That's what I was thinking, too. I like the concept of it as a focus. It's something that, you know, your shaman or your druid would just essentially channel their powers through.
Yeah. If we were to talk about this in Mage of the Awakening terms, this is very much your magus tool, your path tool, etc.
A classical fetish, as it were.
Yes, exactly.
Right. That seems appropriate.
Yeah. To which point, if you have a lizard folk that is a well-known diviner, mm-hmm. with lots of magical skill, they might have multiple turtle lenses. They might have, if I'm going to be divining something for, the health of a child,
right,
that uses this specific pollen, I'm going to have a turtle shell I've stained with that pollen and only that pollen multiple times over years and years that has that deep reddish purplish hue to it.
Right. Perhaps, a turtle shell from a young turtle or something.
A turtle shell that had specific, runes or markings carved into it.
Mm-hmm.
A turtle shell that's been lacquered with the sap of a specific tree.
Right.
Yeah.
You would have to, make it specific for what you're doing if that's going to be your absolute profession.
Yeah.
Or if that's something that you've come to be known for in the village, that sort of thing. So how common would this sort of item be?
I would say that any lizard folk that regularly travels outside of the village they live in would have at least a small one.
That makes sense.
Even if it necessarily wasn't made out of turtle, if it wasn't a turtle shell, they might have a small bowl that they have made to quickly make divinations while on the forest floor.
All right.
To the point that, maybe the chief of the village, especially if they're one that venture out in groups that have war parties, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They might have a turtle shell that has been entirely combed with spider silk,
mm-hmm.
as a way of divining when their greatest enemy might be trying to come for them.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I imagine these would have actually some degree of accuracy given that they are actually channeling magical power.
Yes.
Because a lot of divination things are, even in games, left up to chance.
Yeah.
They're just very much like, oh, maybe, maybe not, that sort of thing. But I imagine this would actually be a useful tool for, DMs, perhaps.
Yeah.
To give information to lizard folk players.
Yeah.
It'd be a useful way for them to give warnings.
Yes.
To say, hey, you're doing something dumb.
I might even say that if you have a lizard folk, PC, that is, as long as they are trained in magic in some way.
Yes.
If they have a magical aptitude, that it would be easy enough to say that if they have a turtle lens, that they don't even have to make any kind of spell casting roll or anything. What they need to be making is a knowledge check to know what they need to put in the bowl, what they need to collect, that kind of thing, to get their accurate divination. Because really, with a small amount of magical ability, it should be accurate no matter what, as long as they're using the right combination of ingredients.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
I take that. I like sure things.
Yeah.
I do. As long as you have the knowledge to pull a thing off, it's a sure thing. And that I like.
Yeah. So, if you're running something like D&D 5th edition,
mm-hmm.
You might have it up to a nature or religion role, or you might even incorporate it as a tool proficiency.
Yeah.
As proficiency turtle lens.
I feel like it would have a tool proficiency and would also require a nature religion role. Probably just nature given.
Yeah. 4th edition D&D, definitely just probably a flat nature or religion role.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and probably...
Or perhaps knowledge.
Yeah. For something like 13th Age, you would probably just incorporate it entirely into a background.
Yep.
For something like, God forbid you're playing GURPS or Rollmaster or something, you would have your own individual skill for that.
Yep.
If you're somehow kidding out a Mage of the Awakening game or I can't remember the other subtitle for Mage, but if you're playing a Mage game that has fantasy monsters in it, well, that's just going to be incorporated right into the bones of the setting. If you're playing Shadowrun, it's probably also just going to be incorporated into whatever your shamanist magic is as a default.
Yeah. I feel like Hermetic Magic wouldn't really put any stock in this. They'd acknowledge, hey, it works for them, but... We can't make it work.
Yeah. But, depending on what your school, you would basically have a school of magic that would include, hey, you're going to use this turtle lens thing.
Right.
So, that's Naga, and that's the
Kalyanka Jungle.
Kalyanka Jungle and the turtle lens.
I actually really like Turtle Lens a lot.
Yeah. Turtle Lens, oh man, good little bit.
Well.
Yeah. We didn't ask for questions last time, but we're still 100% open to questions. You know, maybe not so much for the setting all that much yet. What we've covered surely, but we'll cover everything else eventually. But definitely, if you have any questions about Naga or Merfolk or Dryads or whatever.
You know, anyone. I actually did get a small question just a little bit earlier.
Yes.
Nothing big or about anything particularly important. It was a preference question.
Yeah.
As to whether I preferred the snake bodied or the snake body slash tail or the human body slash tail on my Naga and Yanti. Personally, I prefer the snake.
Same. I feel like having arms just makes it easier to do shit.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But I feel like the snake tail replacing, you know, the lower half and the legs is just really neat and monstrous and different.
Yes.
Which I like a lot.
Definitely. Like, my ideal Naga, Yanti, whatever, is a humanoid torso.
Yes.
With two arms and a head and a snake tail.
Yes.
Although I am, like, you know, I'm fine with scaled humanoids with legs, and I 100% love snake, just intelligent snakes, but
there's a market for all of these things.
Yes.
And I support all of it.
Yeah,
but my personal preference, basically traditional lamias and Yanti abominations and stuff like that.
Yeah, I will say I like it better when the torso half is still very reptilian.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like,
you know,
that.
As much as I'm sure people love their naked ladies on top of snake bodies.
I mean, yeah, I can't argue that at all.
Where can people find us for, you know, issuing more questions?
Well, I have Nullbard at Tumblr. Always open. You can, anon questions, regular questions, doesn't matter. Please send me something. We have...
We've got the Creature Culture Tumblr.
Indeed.
creatureculture.tumblr.com.
Probably the more important one.
creatureculture.tumblr.com/ask.
Yes.
If you so prefer. I'm on Twitter and Tumblr as Pagetish, PagetitiSh.
Yes. I am on Twitter as well. Nullbard, same thing. Literally everything. Always Nullbard.
Yeah. We've got the Twitter for Creature Culture, which is Creatura Cultura.
I'm finally warming up to that name.
Yeah.
It took me a very long time.
Yes. We got to find the way to buy the rights to that Creature Culture Twitter.
Oh boy.
Yeah. And again, a thing that pointedly we have never referenced basically ever, except to say not to reference it. If you would like to rate or review us on iTunes, technically that does make the show more accessible to other people that don't immediately follow us on social media.
True. Yeah.
If you want more people to hear this podcast that aren't, you know, in the web or tree of followers on Twitter and Tumblr, that's the way to do it. And, you know, again, we'd love to hear from everyone.
Oh, definitely. Any criticisms, comments, and concerns that you have aimed at us, we'd love to hear. It doesn't matter what platform you use.
Yeah. Definitely. What's a big topic I'd love to hear about? Tree houses.
Ooh.
Where would you, like, because, like, you know, obviously, like, the underloam going to be very soft, very warm, humid, but dark.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really where I want to spend most of my time.
Oh, absolutely.
But who doesn't want to live in a treehouse up in, like, the canopy, you mm-hmm. know, maybe even, like, have a little, like, deck on an emergent tree?
That'd be cool. Do you think Dryder moms and dads help build treehouses with their kids, teach them how?
Oh, I feel like that would just be, like, oh, let's go live in Grandma. Oh, I'm thinking of Dryads, not Dryders.
I hope I said Dryders. Because things just got real creepy.
Yes. Dryders, so good at that.